Case 22-3835, USA versus Thomas O'Lear. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Shad, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm here this morning representing Thomas O'Lear, and I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. Your Honors, prior to the time the jury pool was ever polled, the district court made the decision that it was going to eliminate 30-40% of the population from even consideration for the jury, from the jury pool. That denied Mr. O'Lear his constitutional right to have a jury of a fair cross-section of the community, and for that reason, this court should overturn the convictions in this case. And so we start with the Durham test, which is the Supreme Court test, which is how we determine whether or not there was a distinctive group that was eliminated from the jury pool, and then that jury, and then that made the jury not a fair cross-section of the community. There was a distinctive group here, and that distinctive group was made distinctive by one fact specifically, and that is that they were unvaccinated. 30-40, again, at the time of the trial, it was 30-40% of the U.S. population and roughly 30-40% of the population that the Northern District of Ohio was pulling from.
I looked at precedent. It seems the courts of appeals have interpreted distinctive group pretty narrowly. So they have excluded one case out of the Tenth Circuit suggested that folks that lived in rural areas were not a distinct group. A Seventh Circuit case said age is not a distinct group, so excluding folks over 70, anybody over 70, those strike me as a bit more distinctive, perhaps, than just somebody who's not been vaccinated. I know those are out-of-circuit cases, but would you disagree with that proposition, or do you think we should just not follow them because they're out-of-circuit cases?
So I would definitely agree with the proposition that there is case law that seems to draw the term distinctive group fairly narrowly and limits it to things like race, gender, things like that. But I would point out two things with regards to that. First, the Supreme Court's never actually defined what distinctive group is, nor has this court ever actually put an actual definition on what distinctive group is. I think the closest that the court came was, there was a case that I cite to in my brief from 1988 called Ford, and in that case, the court at least cited with, it didn't adopt the First Circuit's explanation of what a distinctive group is, but at least cited it with some authority, and it was again a three-part test in and of itself. But so I would agree that so far there's been this very narrow constructive of what constitutes a distinctive group. But I don't think, given the kind of the opposite side of the coin of what happens if we tailor it too narrowly, I think that that's a problem in this case. Because now, I don't think there's any case, other than the two cases that my opponent has cited that talk about COVID-19, and that's the case out of the Fourth Circuit and the case out of the, I believe it was the Fifth Circuit. There, I have not found a case that makes a distinction based upon health or those matters, and that is an area which I think is ripe for abuse, and that's why this court should be very careful in how it determines this case, because it's a whole new field. I think I noted in my reply brief that, you know, if we say that health concerns are not a distinctive group, right, then a court can pick any health concern and eliminate a large part of the population based upon a health concern that it says could hold up the trial.
Do you think health concern matches up to a refusal to take a vaccine? Because some people did it for health reasons, but others were just skeptical because it was so new, whether it would actually help. So I'm not certain that refusal to take vaccine and health problems kind of coalesce.
I agree that they're not coextant, Your Honor, and I think that is, again, part of the problem, because if you look at the reasons that the court gave and the reasons that the government gives as to why this isn't a problem, they're all relating to, well, it was the health of the jury, it was the health of the defendant, it was the health of the district court and the employees. That's the reason, that was the overriding reason why this rule needed to be into effect for this case. And the problem is that they're not coextant, because it's not that it was folks that had COVID-19 and were sick. It was anybody that wasn't vaccinated, and as Your Honor points out, that's a large...
Isn't the problem that what Lockhart looks to tends, and what the courts have always looked to, tend to be immutable characteristics? They are things that cannot be changed. And here what we've got, I know you make the analogy to HIV. I struggle with why that would match here, because that might be an immutable health characteristic. But the refusal to take a vaccine is not immutable. What? You can change it at any time. So why would that make it a distinct group? Because isn't that the mutability of this group the key that courts rely on to make this dividing line between what we can consider a distinct group and what we can't?
So two answers to that, Your Honor. First is, I would agree that Lockhart discusses the term immutability, and it discusses it along the lines of, here's what we've looked at in the past. But Lockhart doesn't go so far as to say that is the standard. And if that were the standard, that would be in and of itself a very big problem. So let's say another example here. Let's say that the court came out and said, well, we're not going to seat in the jury any Democrats. And that is not an immutable fact, because people can change political parties at any time. So when we get to this analysis under that theory, the government would say, look, it's not immutable, therefore this isn't a cross-section problem, therefore there's no jury problem here. And so it can't be that immutability is the only standard to use to determine whether or not we have a distinctive group.
So that's what I'm kind of struggling. So is the fair cross-section requirement, does it come out of the word impartial in the Sixth Amendment?
Yes.
So what's your best argument for how we should interpret distinctive group that matches what you're saying, but also fits the text and original understanding of what impartial means?
And so that, I think, does get us back a little bit to the Lockhart, right? Which is, in Lockhart, the issue was, can we eliminate folks that don't believe in the death penalty? And so the Supreme Court said, well, you know, we require the jury to follow the law, and the law in this case requires that if the facts match up, then the death penalty should be imposed, and because they cannot do that, then it's okay to eliminate them, and then that doesn't make them a distinctive group, right? Here, we don't have any of that that kind of a test going on, because again, you know, we have the fact that unvaccinated persons are not one, we can't point to one thing that they are, other than the fact that they're not that they're unvaccinated.
Doesn't that hurt you? Because it's almost like the distinctiveness goes to whether it's cut out a significant part of the jury pool. But since those who refuse to get vaccinated it's almost at random. I mean, as you suggested, there's a fair amount of African Americans who don't. There's a fair amount of rural voters who don't. So it may still just be like the same exact makeup of everything, but just smaller, and those who got vaccinated. So it's not clear to me that would suggest there's a partiality or a bias problem, because you haven't removed any kind of folks with background understandings that would help or hurt the prosecution or the criminal defendant.
And I do agree that it's kind of a tightrope here, right? Because you have these things that, okay, it points to a specific group, but at the same time, that group is varied. I mean, you do have that in other groups that we have said are a distinctive group. So just because folks are Asian doesn't mean that they, you know, that's the only thing that combined them together, right? There's nothing else. They could be Democrat, Republican, they could believe this, they could believe that. It's just the fact that if we were to say that there were no Asians that were allowed on the jury, we know that would be a problem. But we can't otherwise bind them together. And so this, and so in here, it's the fact that it was such a large part of the population that is completely eliminated from consideration that is the problem in this case. And kind of the fourth...
What is it about that large part of the population that removing them because of the various reasons, the various and differing reasons that they chose not to do that, that would render the remainder non-representative of the community?
Well, I admit, Your Honor, that is a difficult question to answer because we don't know what we don't know in this instance, right? But
it can't be that just because it's a large group, that's good enough and we're done.
Well, I do.
It's got to be a large, distinctive group that impacts what people remain in order to provide a fair trial. And I find the government's concerns about a six-week trial and exposure within the entire court system a reasonable concern.
I believe that it's a reasonable concern as well, Your Honor, and there are many ways in which the court could have addressed those concerns short of simply eliminating everybody from the panel veneer, such as...
It started that way, didn't it? It started out that way.
Yeah, I mean, but they could...
And then it didn't work, right?
Shortly after, and it's, if I can answer the question, my time's up, but shortly after this, we did have plenty of trials where people were unvaccinated, and there were masks, and there was social distancing, and there was all those things that we did that worked but didn't serve to eliminate this entire population. And so... Because it's a Sixth Amendment right, there should have been other measures, less restrictive measures put into place that would have still gotten us there. Unless there are any other questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Elliot Morrison on behalf of the United States, the appellee in this matter. I think it's important to note on this vaccine issue what I think Judge Strange was starting to get into, which was that this judge, Judge Polster, had just had a trial months before in which he attempted to go through this without having a vaccine requirement and immediately encountered problems with jurors who couldn't return to the jury selection process. And so while the defendant in his brief has cited the fact that he did prior to that time issue a reconsideration order saying he would reconsider whether he would require vaccines and was inclined not to require vaccines, he then, by virtue of his experience, in an area where district courts traditionally, as the Supreme Court has recently reaffirmed, enjoy broad discretion to manage jury selection, encountered serious problems in proceeding with this trial. And so it's also incorrect to suggest, well, he could have done masks and social distancing. What could have been done is not what's at issue in a Duren claim or a Sixth Amendment cross-section claim. And more importantly, the judge also did have masks and social distancing. I sat in court every day with a mask on except for when I was examining a witness. So there shouldn't be some sort of presumption.
Isn't that under the relevant test, that just goes to whether you can justify the exclusion? But do you think that means, are you conceding that they have actually met the three prima facie factors?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And I think
what do you think the I take it you would hopefully answer no to the notion that a district court could, in Mr. Schatz's hypothetical, eliminate everybody of a particular political party.
Certainly.
So then it has to go beyond immutability, but it's really tricky. What does the government think the test should be for what a distinctive group is?
Well, I think it's correct, and everyone here has pointed out so far, that there is no specific requirement, but that traditionally it has been associated not just with immutability, but with protected classes. And so I think that really is the starting point. And you're looking for groups that either are a previously recognized protected class or have some similarity at a minimum. And I
hear that there was just a health concern that was driving this decision of the district court. And the question is, how much do we micromanage the district court on determining what precautions were necessary to deal with this virus?
Absolutely. And I think that's where we would get to the state interest were a prima facie case met, is that the court is well within its ample discretion to take this type of action. And as to whether or not this is a distinctive group, though, I think you are getting to a good point.
I mean, Lockhart talks about it has to be completely unrelated to the ability of members of the group to serve as jurors in a particular case. And, I mean, I kind of think it maybe is related in that they could get COVID if they sit with people that aren't vaccinated, according to the knowledge at that time that people believed.
And that they could also spread COVID to other people who were present, and that they, if they did contract it, would, even if they reported it and didn't show up, they would then have to be excluded and isolated for a period of at least 5 to 10 days. And so there's this potential for significant disruption, and the language in Lockhart is impaired. Would this impair their ability to serve in some way? And I think clearly it's reasonable for the court to conclude that this could have impaired their ability to serve. And I think the comparison to Lockhart is particularly instructive here. What the defense is attempting here is a sort of a double bank shot of, on the one hand, saying because we specifically said unvaccinated jurors are not admitted or not permitted to serve here, that we're going to consider that our distinctive group for purposes of how they're selected. But then when getting to meeting all these requirements for how do we decide what is a distinctive group, they fall back to, well, they're disproportionately contains slightly more African Americans, or disproportionately contains a slightly larger group of people of a particular political ideology. But as Judge Murphy's emphasized, people choose not to be vaccinated for a whole variety of reasons. And it could be simply they didn't have the time, they were too busy working. It could be they have a deeply held belief against vaccines. It could be they were concerned and waiting out and seeing what the research bore out on vaccines because it was such a new thing. There's such a wide variety that there is really nothing that coheres this group. And that's what you find in every single one of these groups that has been determined to be distinctive. It can't just be distinctive in the sense that you're able to select for it. It has to be distinctive in some meaningful way that brings the group together, that they share some relevant view. Here, the only relevant view, and that's at a minimum, the only relevant view they've pointed to is that people who choose not to be vaccinated tend, again, not uniformly, not across the board, not with any specificity, but tend to a greater proportion to be suspicious of government information. And then the bank shot first is, well, and the government here is going to be presenting its case. And so the government's evidence, next bank shot is, when it's presented, might not be credited as much when it's presented in this court. That is simply a far cry from what you have in Lockhart. In Lockhart, these are jurors who are directly opposed to capital punishment, and they are being excluded on the basis of that view. And one of the questions they're going to be asked is, should this person receive capital punishment? And what the Supreme Court says is, when it is based on a view such as this, and it has some relationship to their ability to serve, there can be no finding that there were distinctive...
case involved a vaccine mandate going to a jury. Perhaps this might have some relevance. Right. And selecting who's in the jury.
Right. But we don't have that. And I think that comes back to how these folks were excluded. They weren't excluded based on their views even, right? This is not something where we're again, taking a bank shot from the fact that they're not vaccinated and backing into the assumption of a particular
view. That was an interesting question. Do you think the distinctive group, it has to be related to the issue that is going on at trial? And if we're going to tie it back to the Sixth Amendment, there has to be some showing that it's going to lead to perhaps not an impartial jury because it's selected people with predispositions one way or the other?
Well, I couldn't say that I would ask the court to impose a requirement that it directly relates to a particular issue in the case. And of course, that's because you can't have a system of jury selection that removes people from a protected class.
Well, if you get away from immutable characteristics, maybe that is a limiting principle.
And I was just going to suggest that outside of these immutable characteristics, and I should say
why do immutable characteristics even matter? Because it would violate the Equal Protection Clause, wouldn't it? I mean, you almost render it superfluous, though, I guess would be the concern.
And that's what I was going to say about the exclusion of Democrats, is that really isn't a meaningful hypothetical insofar as that would be a First Amendment violation directly as to those individuals. And so I think it's important not to engage in the hypotheticals that take us into
that was a really good hypothetical. I want to come back to that. Do you think it would be a violation if it was that would be quite problematic if it was some type of mandate case and there was some type of fact finding on a government mandate of a vaccine requirement, say it was a civil case or something. I guess it would, if it was a civil case, if there was some criminal law that required mandates and somebody refused to get vaccinated, having individuals who are not vaccinated would skew the pool, I would think, quite a bit.
And I have some sympathy for that, right? If you have an issue that's directly relevant, right, that honestly, I would have to come back to Lockhart and say, well, that just takes you right back to the world of Lockhart. That's a group of people who are directly opposed to the particular issue. And again, we're far from that, right? But even in that circumstance, I think Lockhart might tell you, I'm sorry, I understand the reasoning. I understand why you want these people to be on your jury. But if it relates to their ability to serve, the law says you must have this, then that is a fair for the court to remove you. And the reason why you come to hold this view comes from so many different reasons and sources that we can't really truly consider that group distinctive. Now, I want to be clear. I understand why that's a much closer question. And I take the point that it's a very good hypothetical. It's just a very far cry from where we are here. And I think it's important to acknowledge that even in Lockhart, where it is directly relevant to an issue that is submitted to the jury, where it's about core, firmly held beliefs opposing capital punishment, people's beliefs about life or death, which tend to often to be closely associated with religion, even in that circumstance, the court said, you can't consider this a distinctive group because it is reasonably going through a process of jury selection that is not focused on any of those protected classes or any of those issues.
Has there been any case law? I think it is, because a lot of this has just been untied to anything in the text of the Constitution. I think there is something to the notion that whether a group is distinctive should depend on whether their exclusion could lead to a biased jury. But the cases don't really seem to focus on that. They're almost like purposeless in terms of whether something is distinctive.
Well, and I think you read off a very good list of, and I think the district court's opinion actually had a very thorough list of, here are the types of things that courts have considered distinctive, and here are the many types of things courts have considered not distinctive. And what we have here is something that is far from many of the things that have even been considered not distinctive. And to answer your question directly, I'm not aware of courts imposing a specific requirement along those lines, and I think that's because of this problem where we don't want to presume the views of protected classes in a way that would allow for their systematic exclusion from the jury pool. When just because it can't be shown that they have a view, they tend to have a view or disproportionately have a view that is, you know, opposed to one side or another on an issue in the case. But I very much see your point that to the extent that the textual basis for this claim described in Duren is this word impartial, it does make sense. But I think that that's been given the flesh of ensuring a fair cross-section across certain demographic groups. But I don't think it entitles you to have one that is exactly proportionate on every specific issue in your case, because frankly, that would be impossible. You have a case with five different issues, you could never have something with a representative sample as to all five issues. And that's why it's about the tolerance for having a system that approaches this process thoughtfully and without bias in mind. And I don't think there's any claim in this case that that was approached in any such way. And I think for the reasons Judge Bush illustrated, this was about this judge having tried to do it the other way, encountered serious problems, and rethought it on the fly in his prior trial just a few months prior. And as the Cole case makes clear, that was decided just a couple weeks, I think, before this opinion at issue here in February of 2022. This was in the midst of the Omicron wave. So they're in the middle of another wave of a new variant that is scaring people and spreading like wildfire in the country. And I think the analysis could be very different. If a judge tried to impose this here today, after the national emergency is officially over, when the facts on the ground about the virus are very different, I could see there being a different analysis.
You seem to be arguing whether there's a compelling interest to overcome the prima facie case when you make that point.
That's true. But I guess I'm more going to my sympathy for the district judge that he's just doing the best he can with a difficult situation. And it's important to point out that there's this huge backlog of cases that's taken place. And this isn't part of the briefing, but this court in February, I think, issued a decision essentially approving for speedy trial waivers. And part of the reliance was, look, when you go through the general orders of the Northern District of Ohio, which generally match up with the rest of the country, it was for a whole year, there basically were no jury trials. Then there were periods where you could only have one jury trial per courthouse, or then you could have two jury trials per courthouse. And there were these extreme provisions taken to try and space out the juries. And it led to a lot of problems. So the judge is just doing the best that he can. And he's not, and I think this is where we come back to the prima facie case, he's not in any way targeting any distinctive group. He's only imposing a requirement that's directly related to the ability of these jurors to serve without causing any potential issues.
Can I switch to just one other issue, if you don't
mind? Absolutely, please.
So I thought there was something to the argument that in the vulnerable victim argument, that a victim generally, when I think of a victim, you think of generally somebody who has been harmed. So here, the obvious victim for sure is the Medicare or Medicaid program or the folks that were defrauded. Do you think that there shouldn't, that our case law suggests there just isn't a harm requirement, or do you think that the nursing home patients whose identities were used were harmed in some way? So this is the vulnerable victim.
Yes, and I appreciate you raising this, and I apologize for having spoken at such length on this other issue. And I hope I'll get a chance to address this beyond these 20 seconds. I think the answer is that some form of harm is what is contemplated, at least as to the attempt of the defendant. So I think what you have to do is start with the text of the guidelines. What the guidelines says is essentially anyone who's a victim of the offense, and the offense, of course, is given, and I do see my time has expired. May I?
No, please.
The guidelines define offense generally. That's a term of art in the guidelines, which when you look at the definition of relevant conduct takes a much broader effect, right? And that's itself in the text of the guidelines. And to reaffirm that in the comment to 3A1.1b, it explains that it's not just the offense of conviction, but also any conduct for which the defendant is held accountable under the relevant conduct rules. From there, but it does not give any sort of term of art definition of victim. And I understand you're saying traditionally.
We're not interpreting the word victim alone. We're interpreting vulnerable victim.
Absolutely.
Which to me implies there's got to be a harm. I mean, why would it be relevant whether they're a vulnerable victim or not if there's not a harm?
So I think that the courts have explained, I think, that actually the vulnerability goes to not just that you harm, that your offense, that this caused a specific harm that they were vulnerable to, but that they were vulnerable to being victimized in a way that enabled this crime to be committed without detection. And that is exactly what occurred here. And I do think it's important to say that with victim not being and vulnerable victim not being defined, when we go to the dictionary definition, as the court did in Webster, You end up with a definition that is quite broad and that attaches here, which is that someone who's tricked, duped, subject to hardship, or someone who is used or taken advantage of. And I think it's important to note here, what this defendant did was over a period of years, he would have his company do one x-ray for a patient, and then he would take all of their most private identifiers, social security number, date of birth, member number for their medical insurance, and use it dozens and dozens, sometimes hundreds of times, to submit falsified bills for services that never occurred. And then when he was suspected of having done so, he not only used their social security number, he used images of their most private parts, x-rays that had been previously taken of them, in order to cover his tracks, to pretend as though...
Is your point then, that's what I thought that your point might be, that there's some type of esoteric or emotional harm from the use, but there was no financial harm in this case.
There's no financial harm, and I think...
And there was no situation where the patients were denied some sort of medical service that they otherwise would have received as a result of the fraud.
Right. And we're not arguing that there's a tangible harm here, to be clear. And in fact, many of these patients probably didn't know that they were victimized in this way. I don't want to overstate the facts here. But I think it comes back to that baseline definition. And I think when the court...
I think you could plausibly say they were taken advantage of, but if you have some type of additional... The hardest interpretive questions are where the words can have subtle meanings and subtle differences in meaning. And is being taken advantage of enough under this guideline to think it should apply, even if you can't point to any harm? Assume we think that harm wasn't enough. If it was just being taken advantage of, is that enough? Do you think that would work?
Well, I do think so, and on top of that, I don't think it's just the mere fact that they've been taken advantage of. I think there's a real invasion of privacy. I mean, we have laws like HIPAA for a reason, that your private medical information should stay private.
What was being used of the patients for the fraud?
Name, social security number, date of birth, member number for the insurance companies. And then again, I come back to this, that wasn't enough for him. That was just on the initial submission side. Then once there's any suspicion, he starts manufacturing all of these fake order forms where he's coming up with purported radiology reports for these people and even takes the original x-rays of them and reproduces them, or of somebody else, and reproduces them. And while we focused specifically on the judge's findings is based on the people who were not only in skilled nursing facilities, as all of these victims were, so they are all unable to care for their daily affairs. They're all on Medicaid and not really in a situation where they're likely to be reviewing the sort of explanations of benefits and things of that nature. And specifically, although I think it's good that the defense has retreated from this targeting requirement that traces to a 1994 version of the application note, he was targeting them because he was doing x-rays at the other hospitals, but he chose to use these people in skilled nursing facilities for a reason, because they weren't looking at this, because they were vulnerable. They were vulnerable to this type of identity theft. Of course, they're not vulnerable to being financially suckered in the way that he did.
What of our precedents do you think most supports this analysis of vulnerable victims? I know we have Moon.
Yes.
Moon's relevant conduct issues. We have Webster. But have we, in other case precedent, made the explanation that you're offering regarding vulnerability?
So I think I would acknowledge that there are some of the patients in Moon were harmed in the sense that there was, you know, ineffective treatments, or that there's this possibility they didn't receive treatment they should have received. And so I think some of these cases, there was a more tangible harm that these patients suffered. But I think when the defense is arguing that, that's confusing a sufficient and necessary condition for this. And so I think... when I'm going through this, I would point the court to Ely, which concerns identity theft victims where their identities were used for tax fraud. Clearly, there's no financial harm to these victims, and there's not even a hint of any other type of traditional harm. But they qualified.
Faulty tax returns. Couldn't you argue that they were? Everyone has an obligation to file their taxes. So, couldn't there conceivably have been some repercussion to these individuals in Ely?
There conceivably could have been.
I'm sorry, it was Webster that had that situation.
Webster had the same thing, but I think in Webster there was some discussion of, and I think Webster versus Ely is actually a good distinction to draw, because in Webster I think there was more of a discussion of whether victims had to take sort of, had to spend their time doing sort of recuperating from this. In Ely, there's none of that. And so I think that really kind of puts the puts it on the head of the nail, which is that the point wasn't whether or not they in fact as a result had to go in through and do all this stuff. The point was that their identities were stolen and they were victimized in that way. And the argument was that they had to suffer some financial harm. They didn't. There was no discussion of whether they had to suffer any other sort of harm. And that simply wasn't relative to the analysis in Ely. And that's similar to, I would point the court to other cases that have been cited here, the Etoty case out of the Fourth Circuit from 2012, that goes through and says that the point of the enhancement is not to punish for harming the vulnerable, right? It's not about the harm. It's to deter conduct that preys on vulnerability in order to go undetected. And that's exactly what was occurring here. The fact that these folks are so disabled and are living in such impoverished conditions that they're never going to see a bill for their health care for the rest of their lives doesn't free him from victimizing them. Right?
The red light's been on for a while. I think you need to conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I apologize for going over. I appreciate you indulging me.
All right, let me get to vulnerable victim. I think one of the last things my colleague said is that it preys on their vulnerability. But at the same time, he said that they couldn't be targeted, the mere fact that they weren't targeted isn't an issue. Those are practically the same things. But in this case, they identified the victims in this case. They identified the victims in the indictment, the superseding indictment, and when they asked for restitution in this matter. And at all times, the victim in this case was Medicare, and it was two insurance companies. And those are the only folks that they ever identified as a victim in the indictment. Those are the only folks that they identified as a victim for purposes of restitution. And that is what should control with regards to a vulnerable victim. To answer your question, Judge Strange, I don't believe that this particular issue has ever been addressed by this court. I cited the court to both Moon and I think the Eggleston cases, and I think in Eggleston, which is the more recent one, although I think it might be like 2018 at this point, so it's relative as to what recent means, but in that they said we're not getting there because both of these are plain error cases, right? And so it doesn't meet the plain error standard. But what does a vulnerable victim mean for purposes of this particular guidelines enhancement?
What do you make of the hypo? Suppose a defendant was trying to defraud a vulnerable, the nursing home, to maybe take money from them, but then just didn't succeed. I think so there would be no harm because the defendant was caught. But I would characterize the individuals as victims even though there was no harm in that hypothetical, I think.
Yeah, so the hypothetical is that the defendant was trying to defraud the victim.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, that's pretty straightforward, right? Here, the person or the entity that was trying to be, that the attempt to defraud was happening on was the Medicare program. It didn't matter who the names were. It didn't matter what the x-rays were from. It was all about let's put these in and see if we can get the money from them. And my colleague stated, oh, they didn't, you know, many times they didn't know, they never knew that they were, that their names were even being used. I would submit that I don't think there was any evidence in the record at all that anyone ever knew that was used in this matter. As a matter of fact, there were folks that were already, had passed away who's...
So what, how do we, so you conceded my hypo, which is a hypo without harm.
Yes.
What should be the legal test then?
Then that's targeting, though.
Target?
Yeah, that's the target, right? Then that's what makes all the sense in that case.
We're in some respects targeted, though, because he did use their specific information to defraud. So he used their information to target somebody else, but
But it's no different than any other piece of that puzzle, which is he also used his bank account to get the money. He also used his employees to help further the conduct, right? But we don't consider the employees vulnerable victims. We don't consider the bank vulnerable victim. The mere fact that it's an artifice that's used in the scheme doesn't relate it to victim and then vulnerable victim. I see my time is up. Unless there are any questions about this and or the other issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate both of your arguments, and your briefing was very helpful. We will take the case under advisement and issue an opinion in due course.